I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
Recently, there has been an enormous change in Western fires. In truth, we've never seen anything like them in recorded history. It appears that we're living in a new age of megafires, forest infernos 10 times bigger than the fires we're used to seeing.
A warming climate has triggered increased wildfire activity in the western U.S.
The dryness comes and rises, and piles away, and it's life!
The time has come!
We think that increased wildfire frequency is due to combustion of fossil fuels.
To pay the rent, to pay our share.
That, and that's why they call it a carbon bomb, because if you have a massive die-off, lots of carbon goes into the atmosphere. The forests are holding more carbon than is in the atmosphere, and that could be a carbon bomb.
I have to say that this is really one of the biggest fires that I've ever seen, and very intense fires.
The carbon bomb. Were the recent wildfires in California a sign of global warming? Did you know that the whole American West is tinder? Ready to burn? Today we start with California, but then discover the whole Rocky Mountain chain houses vast dead forests waiting to go up in smoke. They will add more greenhouse gases than the humans who live there. But the top of the world is already on fire. In the November issue of the journal Nature, a team from the University of Wisconsin published a paper calculating the carbon dioxide swirling up from the Canadian North. There, in the boreal forest, stretching across this huge country, state-sized forest fires have been raging, unreported, and unopposed. As you know, scientists talk of global temperatures rising, but the heat is uneven and is hitting Canada and Russia much harder. 10 degrees above normal is becoming the normal. Forests are baking dry in the heat, in a longer season, waiting for the next lightning storm to ignite them. Rainfall patterns have changed, and warmer winters released the mountain pine bark beetle into a whole new range of mountains in British Columbia. Authorities next door are burning their own forests in spots where they suspect the beetle has arrived. They are trying to stop the infection of all the pines in the endless boreal forest that stretches across Canada's north. No one really believes the beetle can be stopped by anything other than a return to the deep, cold winters of the 1970s. And no one believes we'll ever get back to the climate we were born in. Dr. Tom Gower says Canada's boreal forests are no longer a carbon sink storing greenhouse gases for us. They are a net source of global warming gases. We'll interview him. But first, I want to play a recording I made last summer at the Climate Change Despair and Empowerment Roadshow 2007 in Vancouver. American Pat Rasmussen will tell us how a forest activist became a climate activist as well. Who can say it better than Midnight Oil? That band played in the infamous black hole among the giant stumps in a clear-cut former forest in Clackwood Sound, the last home of the island Old Growth, on the far Pacific coast of Canada. Hundreds were later arrested in protests, and that night a huge crowd of activists surrounded the band. Midnight Oil, into the dark, crowded gash in the woods, they sang.
How can we dance when our earth is turning? How do we sleep while our beds are burning?
Thank you. graves.
The time has come to say things fair, to pay the rent, to pay our share.
From her base in Washington State, Pat Rasmussen watches World Forests. She is a vital link between a number of groups trying to save 6 temperate rainforests in the world. Her official title is Coordinator of the World Temperate Rainforest Network. Pat is one of those activists who knows and feels what she knows. It bothers her that the trees of the West are dying in waves, that satellites show browning over massive swaths where green should be, that life goes on as usual for the latte drinkers who don't realize the coming fires could change their lives forever. We'll get to the recent record fires in California, the dead forests in British Columbia, the hidden great fires in Canada's north. But let's tune in to the evolution of forest activists themselves as global warming heats up the mix. Here is Pat Rasmussen at the Climate Change Despair and Empowerment Roadshow 2007, recorded by Radio EcoShock.
I'm talking about forests and climate change just briefly before we get started. I was traveling last summer, just a year ago this time. I went to your inland temperate rainforest to a meeting, and I saw a lot of dead forest in British Columbia on the way. And then I came back, and I had to go to San Juan Island, so I drove over the North Cascades Pass, which just crosses the Cascades Mountains, just a bit south of the border. And when I got to the top, the whole forest was red. You know, it looked dead and red. I said, wow, what is happening? It was very frightening to me because it was as far as I could see, and I took pictures of it. And I got home and I started researching. I said, what is this? What's happening? And what I discovered is that the forests up there, the higher altitude forests, are indeed defoliated by the spruce budworm. And I talked to scientists, and I found that it was widespread in Washington State, in the Cascades, all the way down. And that the spruce budworm is related to global warming because it's endemic in the forests, but as temperature rises, then they spread. And so gradually I got maps of where this defoliation was happening, and I found out that the trees, although they were defoliated in the fall and got buds in the spring, now they're defoliated again because every year it gets bigger. And I got a graph, and the graph of the last 10 years, it was just like this. And then in 2003, it went like that. And so the scientists said that the trees could come back. They might not all die, unless they get to a point where they're too stressed, and then the spruce bark beetle would come in and kill them, and which is what happened in Alaska. And so I was terrified that much of our wilderness in Washington State was affected by this. And then I found that 20 million acres in central BC, the lodgepole pine, has been killed by the mountain pine beetle. And then I did more research. I found that the boreal, some scientists at Woods Hole Research Center in the East Coast had been making satellite studies of the boreal from 1983 to 2002, and that as the temperature was increasing and CO2 saturation was increasing, at first the boreal was turning green, then it started browning. So every year the boreal is browning, and as you probably know, that's a huge forest. Then I remembered a report that came out in 1994 from Greenpeace called the carbon bomb. And the carbon bomb is the forests around the planet hold three times as much carbon in them, in their vegetation, litter, and soils, as is in the atmosphere currently. So if we reach a point, and then I found that trees have an upper limit of temperature and CO2 that they can handle before they start to weaken and can die. So the essence of the carbon bomb is that as the temperature and CO2 increases, then we have forests that begin to die, and then we have fires, so we have more carbon going into the atmosphere. But at the same time, we have less forest, less trees to take carbon out of the air. And that at a certain point, if forest die-off spreads, and I saw in 2006 how quickly it could spread in 1 year. It was over the whole 10 western states of the U.S., and you know what happened here. And that's why they call it a carbon bomb, because if you have a massive die-off, lots of carbon goes into the atmosphere. The forests are holding more carbon than is in the atmosphere, and that could be a carbon bomb. And, yeah, that's very frightening. So I decided that what I need to work on is global warming and climate change. And so I've been putting a lot of effort and work into it, and that's why I'm on this roadshow with Kelly. And the other thing to remember, though, about our forests is that temperate rainforests, you know, that are in this region from Alaska to Northern California, Chile, New Zealand, and Australia, hold the most carbon per hectare of any forest type, more than tropical, boreal, or temperate forests, because we have such big trees, and we have lots of litter on the ground, and the soils hold about half the carbon that's in the forest. So the forests that we have hold a lot of carbon, and Dr. Mark Harmon from Oregon State University says that if carbon is our goal, we should protect our old growth forests, and any other forests, we should let them return to old growth. Because when you cut down old growth, then for the next 10 to 30 years, that area is emitting carbon to the atmosphere. And it takes about 250 years before that area would hold as much carbon as it did before the forest was cut down. So the basic message, he says, is protect old growth forests for the carbon they hold and take out of the atmosphere. Let the forests return to old growth. And if there is management, change it to 100 to 150 rotation, year rotation cycle. So there are things that we can do, like protect our forests. And we can, I decided that the most important thing to avoid the carbon bomb is to reduce emissions. So I'm on a mission to help people reduce emissions, because if we reduce emissions, the natural system has a chance to recover.
That was Washington State forest activist Pat Rasmussen speaking in Vancouver on August 15, 2007. You can hear the Australian speaker from the Climate Roadshow, Kelly Tudhope, in the Radio EcoShock show for August 24, 2007. Find that in our program archive at www.ecoshock.org/cfro.html, or just go to ecoshock.org. Both women gave moving speeches that activated the crowd. This is Radio EcoShock, and I am your host, Alex Smith. We've all heard about the California wildfires. The TV footage was riveting. Nothing human could stop those wind-fueled blazes, throwing fist-sized balls of fire for miles in the air, lighting everything they touched. But no one covers the horrendous wildfires burning across the top of Canada. Even Canadian TV doesn't bother with these blazes, easily visible from space. Deep in our cities, with vision limited to the flying range of news helicopters, we don't even know these fires exist. And yet, they may tip the planet's ecosphere into a new hot state, whether we know about them or not. Our special guest today is Dr. Tom Gower from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Gower has spent years and years in northern Manitoba province, studying that hardy mix of trees that blanket Canada's north. Fires are just a fact of life for this mass of green, just below the cold and treeless tundra. Forests burn and regenerate. These tree species have evolved to expect fire. Some have cones designed to open and replant themselves after a conflagration. Now, according to satellite data, the fire season is longer and much worse than it was even two decades ago. The natural cycle has apparently been interrupted. The forests are burning much more than normal, so much that, according to Tom Gower, we can no longer count Canada's boreal forest as a carbon sink. Much more carbon is being released from this continent-sized forest than the trees can capture. Why is this important? Well, scientific models, the ones that predict climate change, have presumed that the Great Canadian Forest would accumulate more carbon. The trees should be stimulated by the extra carbon dioxide, the theory went. As humans produced more carbon, the boreal lungs, as they have been called, would collect and store more carbon. Like a buffer, scientists called it a carbon sink. Now, a paper published in the prestigious journal Nature on November 1, 2007, by Dr. Tom Gower and his team, claims that theory is not working out. Fires are the wild card, turning this carbon sink into a carbon source. Let's go to the interview. We are honored to have with us S. Tom Gower, the University of Wisconsin-Madison Professor of Forest Ecology. He's been studying the role of Canada's northern boreal forest and climate change. Professor Gower, in a University of Wisconsin Science report for 2006 and 7, you are quoted as saying, increased plant growth means the boreal forest will take in more carbon dioxide and may actually become a stronger carbon sink. But now your new article in Nature magazine for November 1st seems to contradict that, saying the boreal forest is a net source of greenhouse gases. What has changed your mind?
Basically, this most recent analysis using model simulation and accounting for increased disturbance across the landscape in northern Manitoba has shown us that wildfire has basically changed the system from a carbon sink, that is, taking up more carbon than it's releasing, to a carbon source. So it really now is sort of contributing to rising atmospheric CO2 concentrations.
Do you think you could summarize your paper's conclusions for us so that we understand it a bit better?
Yeah, I can try. We basically took a ecosystem process model that simulates carbon, nitrogen, and water, and we've really looked at, using historic climate data, how changes in climate over this almost 60-year period affected the sort of the net exchange of carbon dioxide between the boreal forest and the atmosphere, and then we used historic fire records to also estimate CO2 emissions due to wildfires. And what we found is that the climate, there were good years and we'd see more uptake of CO2 by the forest, and there were bad years and we'd see less carbon taken up by the forest. But overall, it sort of oscillated around some long-term mean without any long or dramatic changes. But the effects of fire on the simulation clearly showed this sort of downward steady trend of the forest taking up less and less carbon. In fact, it went from roughly 60 years ago, a system that this 1,000 by 1,000 kilometer grid taking up carbon, to at the end of the simulation actually releasing CO2 or contributing to rising atmospheric CO2 concentrations.
So I guess we've seen the photos of fires in California. Are we to imagine that in Canada's north there are forest fires that just rage every summer and nobody knows about it, nobody hears about it?
Oh, absolutely. I always chuckle because the fires in heavily populated areas, typically the western U.S. where fire is very prevalent, get lots of publicity, but they're really quite small in size compared to the fires that burn in the boreal regions of Canada, Alaska, and Eurasia, mainly Siberia. I mean, there's just large fires that occur. And in the late 1980s, a fire in northeast China burned a little over 1 million hectares in one fire.
The Black Dragon Fire.
So, you know, these fires are enormous in size. They're really difficult, both logistically and economically, to fight or to combat. And they do consume, you know, large areas. I know in 95, I think it was, I was in Manitoba working, there were 60 or 70 some odd wildfires burning during the month. So it is a very fire-prone system. I mean, fire is a natural part of the ecology of boreal forests.
Well, I think ecologists have presumed in the past that, well, yes, there are big fires. They are natural. They happened before humans came here. But it'll grow back, and things will be good again. But are we now seeing the potential for a positive feedback loop due to climate change, that these fires could leave a lasting result?
That's clearly what the model suggests, because as you go from, you know, accumulating carbon to now releasing carbon, what that's really saying is it's putting more greenhouse gases back into the atmosphere, which cause additional warming, which make the forest even more susceptible to wildfires. And as you've accurately described, we now have a positive feedback loop set up. Now, how long that continues remains to be seen, but it's an important point to make. Fire is a natural component of these boreal systems and a number of other forest biomes, but we now are no longer in that steady state condition. We've moved to some new state, and I think that's reason to be concerned.
I think one important point that hasn't really reached the public as it should, I'm just starting to grasp it, is the pivotal role of soil. And it's in your study, and it's in other scientists that I've talked to about all the living and dead biological life that's in the northern soil that could be released as carbon or as methane if it's wet. Do you think this melting northern soil could deliver an unexpected punch of greenhouse gases to us?
Well, that was one of the key questions we had when we were doing this study is that there was some work done in Alaska showing that when these wildfires occur, immediately after that you get this large release of CO2, mainly because you've got more energy reaching the surface and you speed up decomposition. We did not see that we actually did measurements at a whole variety of different age stands, and we never saw any indication of that. I'd even offer a bit more evidence. I've also got an experimental warming site up in Thompson where we were heating the soil 5 degrees above ambient to, again, test this effect of climate change on the release of CO2 and other greenhouse gases from the soil. And we have not seen any sort of significant increase in CO2 from the warm soil. So it potentially could be a very important threshold, but the fire study as well as the warming study really are not showing that to date.
Well, I wonder, we've seen the startling melt of the Arctic ice sheet this summer, and there has been a lot of talk about what happens if the permafrost melts. But so far in your studies, you haven't seen that's happening right now.
That's right, and I certainly am certainly familiar with the many of those are tundra sites. And they provide a pretty convincing argument that those systems are responding much more dramatically than what we've seen in the boreal forest. But, you know, in those cases, permafrost is sitting maybe 30 centimeters below the soil surface, while in our systems, we either have discontinuous permafrost or no permafrost that we can tell. So a little bit different comparisons.
Now, as I understand it, your studies are based on a large area in northern Manitoba. Is there someone, or even yourself, preparing to study the whole Canadian North and figure out the greenhouse gas emissions coming from wildfires there?
Well, a number of people have sort of done some, I'll call, spreadsheet calculations, just looking at area burn and CO2 emissions. Werner Kurtz there in B.C. is probably one of the world's experts, if not the world expert. And I know he's put together a whole carbon budget for the Canadian forest. So he certainly is recognized as a world leader in some of these calculations.
We're talking with Professor Tom Gower from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Where can people find out more about your work?
Well, it's on the Nature homepage right now. That's the journal that was published in. We also have it highlighted on my homepage. It's highlighted by the National Science Foundation. which is the funding agency that provided funds. That's basically Canada's equivalent to NSERC. And it's also highlighted at the University of Wisconsin homepage as well. So a number of places.
Not hard to find. Well, you know, Tom, we're all trying to figure this one out. We're almost trying to peer into the future, even though science can really only tell us about the present and the past. But do you have some predictions for the future of the boreal forest and its impacts on the overall climate system?
Well, that's probably our next big focus, is we would, with this experimental warming site, we hope to be able to begin to understand how the carbon cycle of the forest may change in a warmer climate. We would also like to use models to predict how wildfire frequency might change in a warmer climate, and then probably couple those together and say, okay, now with future climate forecasts, what will the new boreal forest look like as far as carbon uptake and interaction with the atmosphere? So that's sort of where we're heading, hopefully, in the next 5 years, assuming we can get funding to do something like that.
Is there something we've missed, a message you'd like to get across to people tracking developing climate change?
No, I had one person say, oh, the forests are not good anymore. Well, no, that's not the case. The forests are still trying to take up CO2. It's just that the disturbance regime has increased so dramatically that it's really diminishing their ability to offset rising atmospheric CO2 concentrations. So the trees are still doing their job. It's just that they're being disturbed more frequently, and we think that the increased wildfire frequency is due to combustion of fossil fuels.
We've been talking with Professor Tom Gower, who just published an article in the November 1st, 2007 issue of Nature magazine with startling new evidence about the boreal forest and wildfires in climate change. Thank you for taking this time to talk with us today.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
All right. I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
That was Dr. Tom Gower, lead author of a new article in the journal Nature for November 1st, 2007. We've heard other voices about the possibility of mass die-off in the boreal forest. Our earlier guest, for example, Pat Rasmussen, wrote about it in the Seattle Intelligencer for August 25, 2006. She writes, "In northern Canada, forests are showing signs of heat stress. Tracking forest changes between 1982 and 2003 using satellite data, Scott Goetz, an ecologist at the Woods Hole Research Center in Massachusetts, found that a wide swath of the northern forest was getting browner, not greener, as he had expected. Goetz believes this is some of the first evidence that high-latitude forests may be in decline, following an initial growth spurt associated with warming. A massive Alaska yellow cedar die-off on 500,000 acres of land in southeast Alaska has been documented by the U.S. Forest Service. Scientists investigating the dramatic decline in yellow cedar eliminated all other possible causes except climate change. Yellow cedars live in the higher latitudes and altitudes of the coastal temperate rainforest from Alaska to the Olympic Peninsula. The trees that are dying have been living there for up to 1,000 years in a climate conducive to life. Forests have an upper heating limit that they can tolerate. When heating goes beyond that limit, trees and other plants go into a rest state, a kind of hibernation where they rest until conditions might improve. In that state, they do not convert carbon to oxygen. Further stressed, they die." That was a quote from Pat Rasmussen, coordinator of the World Temperate Rainforest Network, writing in the Seattle Times. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Oh, This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
As fires continue to burn, these mega fires continue to burn, we may see ultimately a majority, maybe more than half, of the forest land converting to other forest, other types of ecosystems.
Wait a minute, did you just say that there's a reasonable chance we could lose half of the forests in the West?
Yes, within some decades to a century, as warming continues and we continue to get large-scale fires.
That clip and the one you heard at the beginning of the show are from the famous news program 60 Minutes. You can turn up your air conditioner and hold on, but the forests of the world are already morphing, migrating, or dying from global warming. In the first part of this Radio EcoShock special, we heard Dr. Tom Gower, author of a new paper in the journal Nature, saying wildfires in the Canadian North are lurching toward a state of growing carbon emissions. World Temperate Networker Pat Rasmussen explained how northern and western forests are suffering.
We need a different viewpoint, and we have Andrea Reimer, the Executive Director of the Wilderness Committee, on the line. Hello, Andrea.
Sure. Hi, Alex.
We've been hearing how climate is endangering forests everywhere in the West. How did your forest action group move towards climate activism, too?
Well, you know, there was a time in forest conservation when you could draw lines on a map around a wilderness area and be reasonably assured that if you could protect that area from logging or mining coming into it, that you would protect the biodiversity within that area. But in the last 10 to 15 years, what we've become more and more conscious of is that even when you have a park created and you have those lines on the map and you're successful at that, that you can't necessarily protect biodiversity. And the reason for that is issues like climate change as well as toxic pollution. So over the last number of years, we've been getting increasingly involved in campaigns of that nature, including climate change. Our first foray into climate change actually was in 1998, when we put out a newspaper about massive forest fires that were sweeping across Western Canada. And at the time, 1998 was actually the hottest year on record since we started keeping thermometer records in the late 1860s.
Can you tell us what the Wilderness Committee is doing these days or plans to do in your climate change campaign?
Sure. Well, the main focus of our campaign right now is right here in the Lower Mainland, where we've been working to rally the public to let the government know that while we appreciate the targets that they've put in on climate change in the province of British Columbia, or that they're looking at legislating in the province of British Columbia, we, they have this massive highway expansion plan, so it's a bit working against those goals. So if Gateway were to go through the Gateway Highway expansion, we would see as much as a 25% increase from tailpipe emissions in the region. And given that that's our biggest single source already of emissions is from transportation, that's a fairly massive impact.
Well, this is just a quick check-in with you, and I appreciate it, but is there anything else your listeners should know about the Wilderness Committee and how they can become involved?
Well, our website is at www.wildernesscommittee.org, and we also have a Facebook group, and either one of those will tell you a lot about events that we have coming up. We do in the neighborhood of 120 events across Canada every year, and our main mission in the world as an environmental group is to make sure that people have a voice to express concerns, and we'd love to see more people involved.
We've been speaking with Andrea Reimer, the director of the Wilderness Committee based in British Columbia. Andrea, thanks for taking my call on such short notice.
Oh, Alex, it was my pleasure.
But we're going to start with those wildfires which are raging across Southern California.
The day began with more wind, more fires, more damage. In other areas, more evacuations. More than 880,000 have now been told to leave home. Qualcomm Stadium has become a city of last resort,
indicating a high fire danger after a prolonged drought has left brush-covered hillsides ready to ignite.
Record high temperatures, record low humidity, and we just got a huge gust of those Santa Ana winds. You put all of that together, you have extraordinarily difficult conditions for firefighters.
I proclaimed the state of emergency in 7 counties.
Firefighters were no match for the wind-driven inferno that tore through the mountain resort communities just east of Los Angeles. Hundreds of houses burned to the ground.
How can we dance when our earth is
Well, what about the California wildfires, so vividly covered by the mass media machine? Were they caused by an evil arsonist, rampant expansion of suburbia, or climate change, or all of those things? The Los Angeles Times was quick out of the gate to deny any link to climate change. The editor's headline blared, "Global warming not a factor in wildfires." The actual article by Alan Zarembo, an LA Times staff writer in October 25, 2007 edition, concludes that climate change is leading to massive fires in the West, but Southern California could be an exception of sorts. Last year, a study in the journal Science found that fires burned 7 times more land in federal forests from 1983 to 2003 than in the previous 17 years. That was mainly due to warmer spring and summer temperatures and an earlier snowmelt that extended the average fire season by over 2 months. The same study made an exception for Southern California, where there was no increase in fire frequency despite rising temperatures. Well, now we know there may be less frequent fires in California South, but they can be huge when they do come. Apparently, frequency isn't all that counts. The LA Times article quoted Tom Wardell, a specialist in wildfires at the National Interagency Fire Center in Idaho, saying, "That is a fire-prone environment regardless of whether we are in a climate change scenario." In fact, despite the editor's twist of denial in the headline, the rest of the article goes on to describe how global warming is drying out the West. The Christian Science Monitor was more balanced, saying, "Experts are mixed as to whether climate change is responsible for recent fires. Taking the big picture, they note that record fires devastated Eastern Europe this summer. Large fires were reported in Australia and South America. In Russia, more than 14 million hectares burned in Siberia this year alone. In the case of Southern California, it's probably too early to tell if this was the exact event that was caused by climate change. Certainly, that wasn't the only cause. As we heard in last week's Radio EcoShock program, water mismanagement in the West is helping the continent dry out. The people are building in former forest lands, trying to get away from the concrete city jungle, or as part of the suburban sprawl that is climbing up the hillsides into nature. We don't yet understand the causes of the Santa Ana winds that drove this fire into a fury. Are these winds worse due to an overheating in the interior? Has the ocean system changed? We don't know yet, but it sure looks like global warming, doesn't it?" Mike Lee of the Union Tribune newspaper wrote on October 30th, quote, "A projection last year by several academic and government scientists said the failure to significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions could lead to 55% more large wildfires in California by the end of the century." In addition, a 2006 study in the Geophysical Research Letters, the publication of the Geophysical Union, suggests that Santa Ana winds may occur more frequently in November and December as Southern California's climate becomes warmer. In turn, that would heighten the risk of deadly blazes." End quote. Then there is Thomas Swetnam, director of the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona in Tucson. His 2006 study predicted much bigger intense fires as global warming develops. He told the Los Angeles Times that such impacts are not 50 or 100 years away, but happening right now in forest fires. But after the 60 Minutes feature called "The Age of Megafires," scientists Thomas Swetnam and Anthony Westerling felt compelled to say there is no proven direct link between higher temperatures and the recent Southern California fires. "The rest of the West, sure," they say, "that's set to burn thanks to climate change, but we aren't sure about this particular case." Meanwhile, the California Air Resources Board reports that the greenhouse gases coming from the California fires in just 1 week is the equivalent to the yearly emissions of 500,000 cars, American style. Associated Press reported the California fires emitted 8.7 million tons of carbon dioxide, more than the annual emissions of the state of Vermont. Here is what we know for sure. 824,000 Californians were forced to flee for their lives. The images you saw on television from the World Media headquarters in California are somewhere in your future. As the globe heats up, the huge strips of the former temperate zones suffer drought, insect infestation, and then fire. The resulting carbon bomb could bomb civilization everywhere with rapid climate change. Meanwhile, the San Jose Mercury News reported that one of the sections eliminated by the White House from the testimony to the Senate Environment Committee by Dr. Julie Gerberding of the Center for Disease Control was this: forest fires are expected to increase in frequency, severity, distribution, and duration. Too bad that we aren't even allowed to talk about it to our lawmakers. Well, let's leave Southern California and move a little inland to the case of the drying Rocky Mountains. Just as Dr. Tom Gower reported earlier in this program, another scientist at the University of California has been looking at unexpected impacts of climate change. Dr. Laura Coopers has been studying forests in the Rocky Mountains. In a BBC program in December 2006, Dr. Coopers warned that a combination of drying and forest fires could change forests from carbon gathering to a major source of carbon emissions. The BBC blog says, quote, Lara's work shows that with increasing temperatures, the fungi and microbes in the forest floor actually speed up their respiration. So the overall effect of the forest is to give up more carbon than they can absorb. End quote. Here is a short clip from that interview.
We reach the final episode in our landmark series about the impacts of climate change on the natural world. Gabrielle Walker presents The Future.
But as our America correspondent Howard Stapleford found out when he visited Laura Keppers of the University of California at Merced, forests won't always be our friends.
My research has really focused on this question of, as climate warms, what will be the response of forest ecosystems here to that warming, and will they have more carbon in them or less? And work that I've done here in the Rocky Mountains in an area called the Fossil Ridge Wilderness suggests that where climate is already warmer and also a little bit drier, you tend to see about half as much carbon stored in the trees and soils and dead wood.
Now, why is that? Why is there less carbon in the drier areas?
Well, there are probably a couple of different reasons. One possibility is that processes like decomposition of the dead organic matter happens faster, so that you don't get this kind of accumulation of dead organic matter over time.
Mm-hmm.
Another possibility is more frequent forest fires. And forest fires, of course, are going to burn up the carbon that's left in the forest. And so if indeed both warming brings kind of faster respiration and or possibly more frequent forest fires, either of those mechanisms could lead to less carbon in the soils and in the trees above ground and in the dead wood, actually, that lies along, you know, the dead stumps and the trees that have fallen down also have a good amount of carbon stored in them.
So as habitats dry out, there's more chance for not only increased forest fires, which will return carbon to the atmosphere, but also the drier the habitat, the more carbon is put back into the atmosphere anyway.
Well, I guess the first part of that is right on. Certainly as the temperatures warm, it'll tend to dry out the forest, which will lead to kind of a higher probability for forest fires.
Mm-hmm.
There's two things going on all the time. There's the carbon that's coming into the forest through photosynthesis,
mm-hmm.
and there's the carbon that's going out of the forest through respiration. And
right.
We've also talked about another way the carbon goes out of the forest, which is fires.
Fire.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so for the ecosystem to sort of have a neutral role in the climate system, what's coming in has to be the exact same as what's going out. As soon as there's an imbalance between what's coming in and what's going out, sort of that residual is either accumulating in the forest and being drawn out of the atmosphere, or it's being released into the atmosphere from the forest.
So you're either going to get more carbon absorbed into the forests,
right.
or the switch
you'll
of
have
that
more
going out.
Right. Exactly. And so what I've found as a way of trying to look into the future is that we would expect more carbon to go out over the long term.
That was from the BBC program Planet Earth Under Threat. It was Professor Laura Coopers, an ecosystem scientist from the University of California. The U.S. Department of Energy recently added a $2.9 million grant to her research in the eastern Sierra Nevada mountains. She will try to determine whether some species will be able to adapt fast enough to cope with rapid human-induced climate change. Now we will move up the coast toward Canada to the pine forests of British Columbia. The government there has released a year 2007 update to their report on timber supply and the mountain pine beetle infestation. In 2003, the BC Ministry of Forests and Range estimated 4.2 million hectares, that's about 10 million acres, of forest was victimized by red attack. The trees turn red as they die from the mountain pine bark beetle, then they go all gray, dead gray. By 2007, the kill jumped from 4.2 million hectares to 13 million hectares, or 32 million acres of dead pines. Missing from the report? Any estimate of how much carbon will be released into the atmosphere from all these dead trees? In fact, BC Premier Gordon Campbell's Greener Than Thou climate announcements, climate impacts are not really mentioned in this government report at all. The whole vision of this pine beetle update is about merchantable timber and the human economy. After all, the government itself is a major beneficiary of the forest industry from stumpage fees and various taxes. It seems to me this report is more about losing money than about losing one of the great natural resources of the world. And this is another thing that drives me crazy about us humans. When governments propose their climate goals or publish their emissions, they never include the huge carbon inputs from wildfires. Even though humans are causing the condition of drying, dying, and burning forests, we don't count the carbon that results. It's like cheating on an exam, but nature doesn't care about our bookkeeping. As the British journalist George Monbiot points out, all that counts is the total amount of greenhouse gases that reach the atmosphere. If we really cared about saving the climate, governments would have to include the emissions from burning forests. If more of our forests burn, then we have to reduce our direct emissions even more to compensate for all that extra carbon. By this inexorable logic, California must take a few million more cars off the road or close some power plants to offset the recent fires. British Columbia must include the inescapable climate loading from the coming fires in future energy planning. If the interior of the province is going to blow up in a carbon bomb, maybe the government will have to stop building new highways and get mass transit instead. We can't fool Mother Nature, not at all. All governments must redo their carbon bookkeeping to include all greenhouse gases emanating from their part of the earth, no matter what caused it. That is what real climate salvation demands. I've asked several research people in the British Columbia Forest Service, trying to get a straight answer to that key question, how much carbon could go up into the atmosphere from all these dead pine forests? Has no one asked the question? Is anyone encouraged to ask it? British Columbia does have one of the best Canadian carbon calculators in Dr. Werner Kurtz at the Pacific Forestry Center in Victoria. Unfortunately, I was unable to reach him in time for this program, but I did get this back-of-the-envelope guesstimate from a brave soul and scientist at the University of Northern BC. Essentially, he says, British Columbia emits about 68 megatons, or 68 million tons, of carbon dioxide equivalent every year. In 2003, the beetle-killed wood, if it all burned, would emit about 111 megatons a year, using government statistics. That number needs to be doubled now. The total carbon value of all the pines in BC might be 450 megatons, that is, at least six times the carbon that humans emit every year in that province. Of course, it won't all burn, and it won't all burn at once. The fires may burn for a decade or more. Calculations about potential pine fires are difficult, but it does make the point that human-induced global warming could emit more carbon in forest fires in some places than the direct greenhouse gases coming out of tailpipes, smokestacks, and agribusiness. The indirect carbon from forest fires may overwhelm our direct emissions, but we don't count forest fire carbon in government reports and in their promises. Stay tuned for big fires in Western Canada. Is the world really burning up? Of course not. But it is heating up, and we can expect really wildfires in many different parts of the globe. As forests burn, we lose more leafy green that was eating the carbon, and due to climate change, many of these forests will never return. The positive feedback loop, so-called, is very, very negative, not just for us, but for all living things. So why don't we change? Here is George Monbiot, the author of Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. This interview was recorded in October 2007 by howtoboilafrog.com and posted on YouTube.
what is going to make us change in the way that we need to? Is it going to take a catastrophe to motivate us to change in the way that we need to change?
I think what has motivated us so far has been a catastrophe. It was Hurricane Katrina. Because in Hurricane Katrina, whether or not that was influenced by climate change, and we just don't know, we got a glimpse of the future. We saw what life is going to be like for a lot of coastal communities around the world if we allow runaway climate change to go ahead and we don't restrain it. And that is, unfortunately, what people seem to respond to. People seem to be interested in catastrophe, almost to have a sick fascination for catastrophe, and to be prepared to wait for catastrophe to provide the moral guidance that they require. Now, because I'm an optimist and because I have a fairly optimistic view of human nature, I think we are capable of acting before we see a catastrophe. But for that to take place, it requires a tremendous effort of political campaigning by people like ourselves. And the excuses for not campaigning are really running pretty dry now. We can tell ourselves that, well, we've got busy lives and we've got jobs to hold down and all the rest of it. Well, fair enough. And I'm not asking anyone to give up their job or to give up their family life. I am asking people to give up watching TV and to use that time instead to help the voluntary campaigns which are trying to mobilize to stop runaway climate change. How could you refuse to do so? And this is the moral issue of our times. This is an emergency similar to that that confronted the world with the rise of the Axis powers. And when our nations entered the war in 1939 or 1940 or 41, they did so knowing that if they didn't enter that war, the consequences would be beyond contemplation. And we're faced with a very similar situation now. The difference is that we're not asking anyone to sacrifice their lives in order to prevent that catastrophe from taking place. We're asking them to sacrifice their holidays to Thailand. We're asking them to sacrifice the big cars they have, sacrifice some of the heat which they're wasting by not insulating their houses properly. It's not a major sacrifice. It really isn't. And have we become so soft and so selfish that we can't make those tiny sacrifices in order potentially to save the lives of hundreds of millions of people? And I really hope we haven't. I don't want their deaths on my conscience. And I don't think anyone wants the deaths of those people on their conscience. But unless we are prepared to make those small sacrifices, and unless we are prepared to campaign to force governments to force us to change the way that we use energy, we will have those deaths on our conscience.
That was British author George Monbiot, spelled M-O-N-B-I-O-T. Find out more at monbiot.com or also howtoboilafrog.com. We're not being asked to give up our lives, as in World War II, just our pollution. George Monbiot had a more radical suggestion at the UK climate camp outside Heathrow Airport this past summer. I'll play the clip for you now. Even though the audio quality is poor, it was recorded in a tent complete with children and dogs. But do listen carefully.
Even before you take population growth into account, so when that's added to the fact that we're going to have something like a 50% increase in population, you can see that that pushes way over 90%, and even before you take the issue of global equity into account, which means that us in the rich nations must cut our emissions much further than anybody else, you realise that we are talking at a minimum of a 100% cut, and it looks like it might have to go to 110 or 115. You laugh, but actually we're talking about sequestration here, and we're talking about such things, for example, as growing biofuel and burying it. simply for growing as much biomass as we can and sticking it back in the ground, creating new coal measures, something, anything to stave off this catastrophe. So,
if we really want to face reality, if we only have 5 years to adapt, as the top scientists say, then Monbiot is quite right. Not only do we need to cut our emissions, we need to find, quickly, a way to capture carbon back out of the atmosphere. But that's a subject for a whole other show. You can help the planet, if only just for a day on November 23rd, that is, Buy Nothing Day. For just one day, humans ask themselves to stop the great conveyor belt that melts natural spaces into handbags and oversized vehicle tires. Personally, I've learned how to go to a mall just to see the humans or to walk inside on a rainy day and buy absolutely nothing. Try it yourself. Friday, November 23rd is Buy Nothing Day. You may be interested to know that the ship, the Weatherbird 2, owned by Planktos Corporation, which we've covered in previous shows, has left its port in Florida and is allegedly setting out to dump about 100 tons of iron into the ocean off the Galapagos Islands. The London Dumping Convention has recently met and warned its 31 member countries against such experiments with the ocean. We'll see whether Russ George, the CEO of Planktos, pays any attention to that. And if he doesn't, well, we do know that Paul Watson is still in the South American area near the Galapagos, and in fact, right now, I believe he's in Chile. We'll keep following that story for you. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll drive our Cadillac Escalade right down Wall Street to see who jumps out in front. As the banks melt down along with American real estate, will the planet get a break? Would a depression be good for nature? Will the new American government have any money left by 2009 to spend on our planned new energy economy? Next week on Radio EcoShock, tune in for Buzz Crash Boom, The American Bust. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for putting up with me.
I'm going cruising in my Woody, lighting up my barbecue, turning on the air conditioner. Nice to see you, CO2. Washing up my brand new surfboard, making pure resilient trees. Once I lived 10 miles inland, now my front yard is a sea. It's gonna be an endless summer, let's all hop in the Hummer. And it's such a bummer that the water is so warm. It's an endless season, dark. No more oil in the desert, we're left sitting in the dark. Now it's summer the whole year long, no one ever sees the snow. Getting hotter every day now, what we'll do God only knows. It's gonna be an endless summer, let's all hop in the Hummer. And it's such a